For our Bible reading tonight, 1 Samuel chapter 8, reading the whole 22 verses. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Now, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all the people are saying to you. It's not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights." Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He'll take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plough his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He'll take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." Then Samuel said to the Israelites, "Everyone go back to your own town."
Alrighty, thanks Alistair. Can I ask you please keep that passage in front of you and also grab the leaflet that you're given. On the inside, there's an outline of what we're going to talk about for the next little while. And like we do every week here at Trinity, there'll be questions at the end. So if there are things that you want to ask about, just store them up and we'll have a chance for that when we conclude. If you look at the top left of the handout, you'll see the story so far. We're in this series in the book of 1 Samuel. In the first week, 2 weeks ago, we met Hannah. Hannah, the faithful woman in Israel, who in her distress turned towards God and not away from him. Last week, in the second talk, we met Samuel, her son, Samuel, who is the last judge in Israel, and the prophet to whom the word of the Lord comes, and whose word God never lets fall to the ground. At the end of last week, we had the question ringing in our heads, so Samuel's good, but what happens next? What's going to come next after Samuel? And the answer is a king, which is why you can see on the top left of your handout, the title of this whole series is Give Us a King to Lead Us. Give Us a King to Lead Us. Well, point one on your handout on the left there, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have, verses 1 through 5. I want to start by acknowledging that Israel wanting a king is not bad in and of itself. In fact, in the bigger and better story that we belong to, God had actually made provisions for a monarchy right back in the Exodus when he rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt. And you can see a reference there to Deuteronomy chapter 17. What's more, as we've been following this story through the Old Testament, you can see on the table there, by the time we get to the end of Judges, which is the last book before 1 Samuel, actually Israel has descended into anarchy and chaos, and the hope is that perhaps a king might restore her fortune. So you can see there on your handout the fourfold refrain, in those days Israel had no king, everyone did as they saw fit. So Israel wanting a king isn't in and of itself bad, except in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1 suggests that the motive behind Israel's request for a king at this moment is not very good. Pick it up with me in verse 1 of 1 Samuel 8. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. And those leaders turn out to be frankly terrible. Verse 3, but his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. And yet what's striking is that we're told in verses 4 and 5, verse 4, so all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, you're old and your sons don't follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. So what's the problem? Well, there's two problems, and you can see I've listed both of them for you on your handout. The first problem is to do with the nature of a hereditary monarchy or dynastic rule. What I mean by that is this. When you recall that Samuel's predecessor's sons, Eli was Samuel's predecessor, his sons were also corrupt and immoral, and Samuel's sons are corrupt and immoral. And when you realize that the essence of a hereditary monarchy is that the son automatically succeeds the king, then having just experienced two really bad examples of dynastic rule, it seems pretty stupid to make the arrangement permanent by asking for a king. Perhaps it's because of verse 4. Verse 4, we're told all the elders of Israel are the ones who are asking for a king. Maybe what's going on here is that the other power brokers in the nation, they've got a personal grudge against Samuel's sons. So this is a request that's designed to freeze out the house of Samuel. Although, as I said, it's a pretty stupid way to approach it. Pretty stupid to deal with the specific problem of Samuel's sons by entrenching a hereditary monarchy forever. Doesn't seem that smart. But the big problem, this is point two on your handout, problem number two, it comes at the end of verse 5. Verse 5, appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. Appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. So why is that such a bad thing for Israel to ask for? Well, because the whole point is that Israel is not like all the other nations. In fact, compared with all the other nations, in God's sight, Israel is chosen and special and treasured. Look at the passage I printed there for you at the bottom left of your handout. This is from Exodus chapter 19. This is the episode where Moses goes up the mountain. He's just about to receive the Ten Commandments. Look at what we're told. Chapter 19, verse 3. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Exodus is reminding us that what God has done is deliberately single Old Testament Israel out for special treatment. And so, by asking for a king, so they can be like all the other nations, they are literally throwing away their most favored nation status. Isn't that extraordinary? They're willing to give up that incredible privilege of being chosen by God himself so they can be like everyone else. Even after the disastrous experience under Samuel's sons and Eli's sons suggests this is not going to end well. All of which, of course, begs the question for us then, why? Why do they want a king? Is it for the pageantry? You know, for the pomp and ceremony of having a monarchy that lasts from generation to generation? Or, and this is me reading back from our day and age, is the reason they want a king for the possibility of a head of state who rises above the grubbiness of partisan politics? Well, let's see how God responds to their request. And we're at point two now on the right-hand side of your handout. Point two, it is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. Verses 6 through 18. Three parts to this middle part of the chapter. Firstly, Samuel's reaction to their request in verse 6. Now, no surprise here, Samuel is not very positive about their request for a king. We're not told why exactly, although it is possible from what God is about to say that the reason Samuel's not happy is because he takes it personally. That is, in asking for a king, the people are rejecting him and his sons. Although, having said that, presumably Samuel is aware of just how bad his sons are. It's worth pointing out that although Samuel is, look at verse 6, he is, we're told, displeased, I think that's probably a bit of a mild understatement. Although he's displeased, notice what Samuel does before he replies to the elders. The first thing he does, verse 6, is that he prays to the Lord. He prayed to the Lord. Can you see that Samuel is being portrayed in the same way as Hannah? Remember Hannah, the faithful woman in Israel? When she was confronted with her awful circumstances, in her case it was the pain of infertility, what she did was that she turned towards God, not away from him. And Samuel does just the same. You're very well aware from our journey through the Old Testament that I frequently warn against moralizing from the Old Testament, about holding up the Old Testament characters as examples to follow. The reason I warn against that is because generally they're not very good examples. But occasionally they are. And this is one of those situations. From Samuel, I think we learn that when we're stressed, when we're upset, when we're in pain, when we're confronted by ungodliness, the first thing we do is bring it all to God in prayer. Because he cares. And he's listening. Well, if that's Samuel's reaction to their request, what does God make of their request? This is point two there. God's analysis of their request, verses 7 and 8. Listen to what God rather bluntly tells Samuel to say. Verse 7. God says to Samuel, "It is not you they have rejected, but they've rejected me as their king. As they've done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you." God says there are two problems with the people's request. The first is that, well, actually, this is less a rejection of Samuel and his sons. It's more a rejection of God as their true king. And that's the reason, of course, why the title for today's talk, at the top left of your handout, "The King of Israel." It's not a person. It's always been God. And so here's the second problem with their request for a human king. When you consider just how good God has been to them in the past, they will never do any better than with him as their king. The specific example that's given there in verse 8 is how God rescued them from slavery in Egypt. Now, I don't think we pause enough to reflect on the magnitude of what took place in the Exodus. This is unheard of in world history. It's never been repeated again. No nation has ever given up her slaves literally overnight, except that's what Egypt does when God ordains it for his people. So how could Israel possibly imagine they will do any better than under God? Yet, sadly, what's happening in 1 Samuel 8 is nothing new. From the outset, actually, Israel, we're told, has consistently forsaken her own God and turned to other gods. And so, in many ways, this comes as no surprise at all. Well, 2.3, they're God's response then to their request, verses 9 through 18. So what does God say? Well, we start at verse 9, and verse 9, I think, actually, it perfectly encapsulates the wonderful way that God treats us. Look again at verse 9. God says to Samuel, "Listen to them, but warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights." Listen to them, but warn them solemnly what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights. Now, I've given you a note there on your handout. The reason why I think this is such a beautiful statement is that it perfectly encapsulates how God treats us. In saying, listen to them, but warn them solemnly, we see that God gives them both agency and he holds them accountable. God gives them agency, that is, he upholds the dignity of humanity. He upholds the power of self-determination, of our right to decide and to make choices for ourselves. But at the same time, God holds us accountable. In the end, when he gives us what we ask for, he lets us reap what we sow. What this does, I think, is that it paints God in a pretty positive light. Ironically, people often ask, how is it that God can be in control of things and yet still enable people to have moral choices and to make real decisions? Well, I think that's what we see here. We see a picture here of a God who cares enough to warn us of the consequences of our actions, but a God who respects us enough not to force us to a particular outcome. He cares enough to warn us of the consequences of our actions, but he respects us enough to not force us to particular outcomes. And I wonder, in your conversations with friends and family who aren't Christian, when they raise this question about, so how is it that God can be all-powerful and yet we still make real decisions? I wonder if this is the picture that you've ever tried to paint. How might you do so? Because don't you think that perhaps they'd just be a little bit intrigued by a God who treats us this way? Well, at this point we're going to listen in as Samuel now relays God's warning to the Israelites in verse 10. Look at verse 10. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who are asking him for a king. Now, just a couple things to notice here. Firstly, it's not just the elders of Israel, like back in verse 4. Now we're told it's all the people who are asking him for a king. And I think the inference actually is that the whole nation has gathered together and participates in this request. But what Samuel does, actually, is he does exactly what a prophet is meant to do. He tells all the words of the Lord. He tells all the words of the Lord. Or in language that you and I are more familiar with, what Samuel does is he tells the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Even though it's going to be very hard to hear. Well, as to the actual warning, that's in verses 11 through 17. Now, the hint that they're heading down the wrong path is the repeated phrase in verses 9 and 11. I've noted it there on your handout. It's that phrase, this is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. Now, of course, as soon as you hear language like rights, you don't imagine this is going to end very well for the people. So I want you to see if you can spot the theme as I reread verses 11 through 17. Okay, can you spot the theme as I reread verses 11 through 17? And I can see some smirks on your face because I've actually put it in bold, so it's not very hard to spot, but we'll see how we go. Okay, listen in. Verse 11. He said, this is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he'll assign to the commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plough his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants, the best of your cattle and donkeys, he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks. You yourselves will become his slaves. Not very hard to spot, is it? The king will take your sons. The king will take your daughters. The king will take your produce. The king will take your servants. The king will take the best of your cattle, a tenth of your flocks. The king will even take you. You will become his slaves. And if I can put it this way, as a spoiler alert, that's exactly what the first king of Israel does. There's a reference there for you from 1 Samuel 14. In just six chapters' time, this is what the first king of Israel does. Saul, verse 52, all the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines, and whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. And when all this plays out exactly the way God has warned them, verse 18, when that day comes, you'll cry out for relief from the king you've chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. You reap what you sow. You get what you ask for. And God is saying you'll have no one to blame but yourself. That is, of course, both the dignity of agency and the gravity of accountability. At the end of the day, God treats us the way we demand to be treated. In the bigger and better story we belong to, this reminds me actually of another spoiler alert. Of a day when, hundreds of years later, God's people will call for the death of their own king, and they'll choose a convicted insurrectionist and a murderer as their saviour. Matthew 27, it's there on your handout. As Jesus is crucified, the people answer, his blood is on us and on our children. Well, after God's warning, what do the people do? Is it enough to change their minds? Well, sadly not. Point three, then we will be like all the other nations, verses 19 through 22. Pick it up with me one last time in 1 Samuel 8. We're at the last paragraph there, verse 19. Verse 19, but the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we'll be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. Tragically, the people stick to their initial request because their underlying desire hasn't changed one bit. They still want to be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles on our behalf. Now, I just want to pause and point out once again how completely stupid that is. Completely stupid when you consider how, until now, God is the one who has always fought their battles. God is the one who destroyed the might of the Egyptian army when they came through the Red Sea. And we saw just last week, the Ark of the Covenant defeated the Philistines even without the Israelites' help. God is the one who has always fought their battles. But instead they want a king who'll do it for them. And so to one last spoiler alert, in 9 chapters' time, in 1 Samuel 17, the Philistines will rise up again against the Israelites, and what they do this time is that they send out their champion, a guy by the name Goliath. And what does the king of Israel do? Does he go out and fight the nation's battles on their behalf? Well, actually, you know he doesn't. That's why it's called David and Goliath, not Saul and Goliath. So, Samuel takes their answer back to the Lord. And God simply says, paraphrase, very well, give them what they want. What's interesting, you might have noticed at the end of that last paragraph, is that the section concludes by Samuel sending everybody home. He doesn't immediately give them a king. I don't know why that happens, but I'm pretty sure that what Samuel wants is for us to come back next week. And so read ahead, chapters 9 through 15. That's exactly what's going to happen. We're going to see the grant of the first king next week. So read ahead just a few chapters and you'll come well prepared. All right. Let me try and finish then with a couple of reflections for us today. We're down at the bottom right now, so what for us? And I want to say two things. I want to talk about, firstly, fitting in versus standing out. And then I want to finish by talking about the kind of king our whole world needs. Firstly, fitting in versus standing out. This picks up on the idea that the people's request for a king is so that they would be like all the nations around us. Can I say that for us Christians, I get that every single one of us has a deeply ingrained desire to want to fit in and to want to not stand out in our world. We all long to be like the world around us, even to be recognized by our world, to be honored and esteemed. And I want to say that that's not a bad thing to wish for. And I get that actually it can create opportunities in those moments where we have that chance to describe how God's blessing is actually the reason why we might have been so successful. That gives us a chance to share about our faith in Jesus. Yet what I want to say tonight is that fitting in is always an exercise in futility for Christians. Fitting in is always an exercise in futility for Christians. God's people, whether Old Testament Israel or New Testament believers today, we will never be like everybody else. In fact, if we ever manage to succeed, it's because we've become like everybody else. It means we belong to this world and not to our God. This came home to me the other day when I became a Christian when I was about 16 at high school. I went to a very secular high school. And so one of the things that I worked out very quickly was that having become a Christian, it was really important to make sure that my new church friends never met my school friends. Last week, I ran into someone from my school who I hadn't seen since leaving school. So this is the first time I've seen this person in 35 years. There you go. Tells you how old I am. Here's the funny thing. He's now a Bible college lecturer. And I'm a minister. But I don't think I'll ever forget what he asked me when I saw him last week. He asked me, "Were you a Christian at school?" I want to say that not fitting in, despite all that, it's not doom and gloom. I want to say that God's people, even if we never fit in this world, we are not destined to be unloved, to be unaccepted, to be unwanted or unappreciated or unapproved. Why? Because we've been chosen by God, chosen by the Lord of the universe, the maker of heaven and earth. So quite frankly, ultimately, who cares what anyone else thinks of you if he has chosen us? Nothing else matters. See how the language of Exodus 19 that talked about Israel being a chosen people, see how that language is reimagined and reinterpreted in the New Testament. The passage at the bottom right there, this is 1 Peter chapter 2. This is Peter writing to believers everywhere, Christians everywhere. Listen to what he says. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you'd not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Do you hear what Peter is saying? We are his people. We are God's special possession. And God shows us mercy when, quite frankly, you and I deserve judgment. God calls us out of darkness that we might live in his wonderful light. No wonder we cannot help but sing his praises, longing that others might enter into this as well. Sometimes I think Christians imagine that, well, if we just fit in, if we look the same as everybody else, then maybe one day after years of patience, we might get to build a bridge with the unbelievers in our lives. That's the reason I think why most Christian apologetics tries to show how Christianity is just a little bit more attractive than the alternative. It's not too weird. It's not too radical. It gives just a little bit better outcomes than what the world is offering. Basically, if you become a Christian, you get an incremental upgrade or you get a minor bug fix. Because we never really want to stand out too much. And yet the thing is, Christians will always be radically different. If for no other reason than that our world operates on merit that you must earn, not on mercy that you can only receive. Our world operates on merit that you must earn, whereas God gives mercy to those who will receive it. The other reason why Christians will always be radically different is because the king we serve, well, he never fit in either. And so this is the last thing I want to say. Down there at the bottom right, point to the kind of king our whole world needs. And this passage in 1 Samuel 8 has been all about the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. But ultimately, our bigger and better story is not just for Old Testament Israel, it's for all the peoples of the world. And so, given how inadequate even the best of Israel's kings would be, what 1 Samuel 8 does is that it leaves us longing for a king who rules differently, a king whose rule is better. Look at Matthew 27, verse 41. Here, Jesus has been crucified, and his own people mock him. Verse 41. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and then we will believe him. He's the kind of king who doesn't take and take and take. He's the kind of king who gives. It's the kind of king who gives his life, who lays down his life for his people. In fact, at the hands of his own people. For this is the only way in which you and I might receive mercy. our sin must be dealt with. So yes, Jesus could have climbed down from the cross, but if he doesn't bear our sin, we must. This is the kind of king not just for Old Testament Israel. This is the kind of king for the whole world. So I'm going to pray that his name might be made known to the ends of the earth. Will you join me as I do that? Heavenly Father, thank you for all that you've done for us in Jesus. Thank you for his death, his resurrection, the promise of his return. Thank you that he is a king who, in the laying down of his life, gives us hope of an eternity with you. So we pray, through us, make the name of your Son known to the ends of the earth. Amen.